he'd be risking the ingression of police into the basement where he was concealing the remains and belongings of at least 5 women. However, Creed's arrogance and sense of inviolability seemed to have known no bounds by this time. He was also stockpiling pills in larger quantities than ever, which brought him into contact with more than one street dealer. This made him more widely recognizable. One of his new drugs contacts was Michael Cleet, who sold barbiturates stolen from a contact at a pharmaceutical company. Cleet would later cut a deal with the police in exchange for his testimony at the killer's trial. Creed, he testified, had asked Cleet whether he or his contact could procure a doctor's prescription pad. Police suspected that Creed was hoping to fake a prescription for Violet to explain her possession of the means to overdose. In spite of the coffee, Strike's eyelids began to droop again. After another couple of minutes, his head sank sideways and the book slipped out of his slack grasp. When he woke up again, the sky outside had turned coral pink, the laughing teenagers were gone, and he found himself 10 minutes from Truro Station. Stiffer than ever, and in no mood for the family reunion, he wished he was heading back to his attic flat for a shower and some peace. Nevertheless, his heart lifted slightly when he saw Dave Polworth waiting for him on the platform. The bag of chocolate hedgehogs rattled slightly as Strike clambered laboriously off the train. He'd have to remember to give the broken one to Luke.
"All right, Diddy,"
said Polworth, as they shook hands and patted each other on the back, Strike's Waitrose bag impeding a hug.
"Thanks for picking me up, chum. Really appreciate it."
They drove to St. Moore's in Polworth's Dacia Duster, discussing plans for the following day. Polworth and his family had been invited to the scattering of the ashes, along with Carenza, the Macmillan nurse.
"'Sept it's not going to be a scattering," said Polworth,
driving through country lanes as the sun turned into a burning coal on the horizon.
"More like a floating."
"How's that?"
"Lucy's got an urn," said Polworth. "Water soluble, cotton and clay. She was showing me last night. It's supposed to look like a flower. You put the ashes inside and the whole thing bobs away and dissolves."
"Nice idea," said Strike.
"Prevent stupid accidents," said Polworth, pragmatically. "Remember Ian Resterick from school? His granddad wanted his ashes thrown off Land's End. The dozy fuckers chucked them off in a high wind and ended up with their mouths full of the old boy. Resterick told me he was blowing ash out of his nose for a week after."
Laughing, Strike felt his phone buzz in his pocket and pulled it out. He was hoping the text might be Robin, perhaps telling him she'd already located Betty Fuller. Instead, he saw an unknown number. "I hated you as much as I did because I loved you so much. My love never ended, but yours did. It wore out. I wore it out." Polworth was still talking, but Strike was no longer listening. He read the text through several times, frowning slightly, then put the phone back in his pocket and tried to concentrate on his old friend's anecdotes. At Ted's house, there were cries of welcome and hugs from his uncle, Lucy, and Jack. Strike tried to look delighted to be there, in spite of his fatigue, and knowing he'd have to wait to sleep until everyone else had gone to bed. Lucy had made pasta for everyone, and when she wasn't tending to everybody else's needs, telling Luke off for kicking Adam or picking at her own plate, she teetered on the verge of tears.
"It's so strange, isn't it?"
she whispered to her brother after dinner, while Greg and the boys, at Greg's insistence, were clearing the table.
"Being here without her?"
And without a pause, she hurried on.
"We've decided we're going to do the ashes in the morning, because the weather looks good, and then come back here for Easter lunch."
"Sounds great," said Strike.
He knew how much importance Lucy placed on arrangements and plans, on having everything done in the right way. She fetched the urn and admired the stylized white lily. Ted had already placed Joan's ashes inside.
"That's great. Joan would have loved it," he said,
with no idea whether that was true or not.
"And I bought pink roses for all of us to throw into the water with it," said Lucy,
tears welling again.
"Nice touch,"
said Strike, suppressing a yawn. He really did just want to shower, then lie down and sleep.
"Thanks for sorting all this out, Luce. Oh, and I brought Easter eggs for the boys. Where'd you want them?"
"We can put them in the kitchen. Did you remember to get some for Roz and Mel, too?
Who?
Dave and Penny's girls. They'll be coming tomorrow, too.
Fuck's sake.
I didn't think. Oh, stick, said Lucy. Aren't you their godfather?
No, I'm not, said Strike, doing his very best not to sound short-tempered. But fine, yeah. I'll nip down the shops tomorrow morning and buy some more.
Later, when he was at last alone in the dark sitting room, lying on the sofa with which he'd become so unwillingly familiar over the past year, his prosthetic leg propped against the coffee table, he checked his phone again. There were, he was pleased to see, no more messages from the unknown number, and, exhausted as he was, he managed to fall asleep quickly. However, at shortly before 4 in the morning, the phone rang. Jerked out of a profound sleep, Strike groped for it, registered the time, then raised it to his ear.
"Hello?"
There was a long silence, although he could hear breathing on the end of the line.
"Who is this?"
he said, suspecting the answer.
"Bluey,"
came a tiny whisper.
"It's me."
"It's 4 in the morning, Charlotte."
"I know,"
she whispered, and gave what might have been a giggle or a sob. She sounded strange, possibly manic. Strike stared up at the dark ceiling, his aunt's ashes a mere 12 feet away.
"Where are you?"
"In hell."
"Charlotte."
She hung up. Strike could hear his own heart beating with ominous force, like a kettle drum deep inside a cave. Red-hot threads of panic and dread darted through him. How many more burdens was he supposed to bear? Had he not paid enough, given enough, sacrificed enough, loved enough? Joan seemed very close just now. In the darkness of her own sitting room, with her ornamental plates and her dried flowers, closer even than her dusty remains, in that vaguely ludicrous white lily, which would look so puny and insignificant, bobbing away on the wide sea, like a discarded paper plate. He seemed to hear her last words as he lay there.
"You're a good man, helping people. I'm proud of you."
Charlotte had called him from the same unknown number she texted from earlier. Strike's exhausted mind now eddied around the known facts, which were that Charlotte had suicide attempts in her past, that she was married with children, and that she'd recently been committed to a mental facility. He remembered his resolution of weeks ago, to phone her husband if she sent him any more self-destructive messages, but Jago Ross wouldn't be at his merchant bank at 4 a.m. on an Easter weekend. He wondered whether it would be cruelty or kindness to ignore the call, and how he'd bear the knowledge that she'd overdosed if he didn't respond. After a very long 10 minutes, during which he half expected her to call him back, Strike sat up to compose a text. "I'm in Cornwall. My aunt's just died. I think you need help, but I'm the wrong person to give it to you. If you're alone, you need to get hold of someone and tell them how you're feeling." The terrible thing was how well he and Charlotte knew each other. Strike knew just how pusillanimous, how disingenuous Charlotte would find this bland response. She'd know that some small part of him, shrunken by determined abstinence, though never eradicated, felt a pullback towards her, especially in this extremity, not only because he'd assumed responsibility for her happiness for years, but because he could never forget that she'd come to him when he was at his lowest ebb, lying in a hospital bed with a freshly amputated leg, wondering what possible life there was for him now. He could still remember her appearing in the doorway, the most beautiful woman he'd ever seen, and how she'd walked down the ward towards him and kissed him wordlessly on the mouth. And that moment, more than any other, had told him that life would continue, would contain glorious moments of beauty and pleasure, that he wasn't alone anymore, and that his missing leg didn't matter to the woman he couldn't forget. Sitting in the darkness, atypically cold because of his exhaustion, Strike typed 4 more words. "It will get better," and sent the message. Then he lay back down and waited for the phone to vibrate again, but it remained silent. And eventually, he fell asleep. He was woken inevitably by Luke bursting into the sitting room. While he listened to Luke clattering around the kitchen, Strike reached for his phone and looked at it. Charlotte had sent 2 more texts, one an hour previously, the next half an hour later. "Bluey, I'm sorry about your aunt. Is it the one I met?" And then, when Strike hadn't answered, "Am I evil? Jago says I am. I used to think I couldn't be, because you loved me." At least she wasn't dead. With a vice-like sensation in his belly, Strike sat up, put on his prosthesis, and attempted to shut Charlotte out of his mind. Breakfast wasn't a particularly relaxing affair. The table was so crowded with Easter eggs, it was like being in some cartoonish nest. Strike ate off a plate on his lap. Lucy had bought Strike and Ted an egg each, and the detective now gathered that he should have bought his sister one as well. All three boys had tottering piles.
"What's a hedgehog got to do with Easter?"
Adam asked Strike, holding up his uncle's offering.
"Easter time's spring, isn't it?" said Ted,
from the end of the table.
"It's when hibernating animals wake up."
"Mine's all broken,"
said Luke, shaking the box.
"That's a shame," said Strike,
and Lucy shot him a sharp look. She was tense, telling off her sons for looking at their phones during the meal, glaring at Strike when he checked his own, constantly glancing out of the window to check the state of the weather. The detective was glad of an excuse to get out of the house to buy Polworth's daughter's Easter eggs, but he'd walked barely 10 yards down the sloping road, cigarette in hand, when the family pulled up in their Dacia. When Strike confided his errand in an undertone, Polworth said,
"Fuck that! They got enough chocolate for a year at home. Leave it."
At 11 o'clock, with a leg of lamb left in the oven and the timer set, after Luke had been told that no, he couldn't take his iPad on the boat, and one false start, due to the need to return to the house for Polworth's younger daughter to have a pee, she'd insisted she didn't need before they left, the party made its way successfully down to the harbour, where they met Carenza the nurse and boarded Ted's old sailing boat, Jawanet. Strike, who'd once been his uncle's proud helpmeet, no longer had the balance to work either sails or rudder. He sat with the women and children, spared the necessity of making conversation by the noise of wind against canvas. Ted shouted commands to Polworth and Jack. Luke was eating chocolate, his eyes screwed up against the cold breeze. Polworth's daughters were huddled, shivering beside their mother, who had her arms around them. Tears were already trickling down Lucy's cheeks as she cradled the flat white urn in her lap. Beside her, Carenza held a bunch of dark pink roses, loosely wrapped in cellophane, and it was left to Greg and Polworth to shout at the children to watch out for the boom as they tacked around the peninsula where St. Maur's Castle stood sentinel. The surface of the sea changed from second to second, from rippling plain of sage and grey to mesh of diamond-bright sparkles. The smell of ozone was as familiar and comforting to Strike as that of beer. He was just thinking how glad he was that Joan had chosen this and not a grave, when he felt his phone vibrate against his chest. Unable to resist the temptation to read what he knew would be a text from Charlotte, he pulled it out and read it. "I thought you'd come back. I thought you'd stop me marrying him. I didn't think you'd let me do it." He put the phone back into his pocket. Luke was watching him, and Strike thought he saw the idea occur of asking why Uncle Cormoran could look at his phone, whereas he was banned from bringing his iPad. But the look his uncle gave him seemed to make him think better of the idea, and he merely stuffed more chocolate in his mouth. A feeling of constraint seemed to fall over everyone, even Luke, as Ted turned the boat into the wind and brought the boat slowly to a halt, the sail flapping loudly in the wind, St. Maur's Castle now the size of a sandcastle in the distance. Carenza handed around the roses, one for everyone except Ted, who took the remainder of the bouquet between the hands that were forever sunburned. Nobody spoke, and yet the moment didn't feel anticlimactic. While the sails flapped angrily overhead, Ted bent low over the side of the boat and dropped the urn gently into the sea, murmuring his farewell, and the object Strike had imagined would look inadequate and tawdry became, precisely because of its smallness as it bobbed gallantly on the ocean, affecting and strangely noble. Soon, the last earthly remains of Joan Nancarrow would dissolve into the sea, and only the pink roses, tossed one by one into the sea by each of them, would remain to show the place where she disappeared. Strike put his arm around Lucy, who rested her head on his shoulder as they sailed back to shore. Roswin, the elder of Polwarth's daughters, broke into sobs initially provoked by the sight of the urn vanishing in the distance, but sustained by her enjoyment of her own grief and the sympathy of her mother. Strike watched until he could no longer see the white dot, then turned his eyes towards shore, thinking of the leg of lamb waiting for them back at the house. His phone vibrated again, minutes after he'd regained firm ground. While Polwarth helped Ted tie up the boat, Strike lit a cigarette and turned away from the group to read the new text.
"I want to die speaking the truth. People are such liars. Everyone I know lies in such, if them, swant to stop pretending."
"I'll walk back," he told Lucy. "You can't," she said at once. "Lunch will be ready for us." "I'm going to want another one of these," Strike said firmly, holding up his cigarette in her disapproving face. "I'll meet you up there."
"You want company, Diddy?" asked Polwarth. "Penny can take the girls back up to the house."
"No, you're all right, mate," said Strike. "Need to make a work call," he added quietly, so that Lucy couldn't hear. As he said it, he felt his mobile vibrate again.
"Goodbye, Coram," said Carenza, her freckled face kindly as ever. "I'm not coming for lunch."
"Great," said Strike. "No, sorry, I mean, thanks for coming, Carenza. Joan was so fond of you."
When Carenza had finally got into her mini, and the family's cars were driving away, Strike pulled out his phone again.
"Never forget that I loved you. Goodbye, Blues. Kiss."
Strike called the number. After a few rings, it went to voicemail.
"Charlotte, it's me," said Strike. "I'm going to keep ringing till you pick up."
He hung up and dialed again. The number went to voicemail a second time. Strike began to walk because his anxiety required action. The streets around the harbour weren't busy. Most people would be sitting down to Easter lunch. Over and again he dialed Charlotte's number, but she didn't answer. It was as though a wire was tightening around his skull. His neck was rigid with tension. From second to second, his feelings fluctuated between rage, resentment, frustration, and fear. She'd always been an expert manipulator. She'd also narrowly escaped death by her own hand, twice. The phone might be going unanswered because she was already dead. There could be sporting guns at the Castle of Croy, where her husband's family had lived for generations. There'd be heavy-duty medications at the clinic. She might have stockpiled them. She might even have taken a razor blade to herself, as she'd once tried to do during one of her and Strike's more vicious rows. After calling the number for the tenth time, Strike came to a halt, looking out over the railings at the pitiless sea, which breathed no consolation as it rushed to and then retreated from the shore. Memories of Joan and the way she'd clung so fiercely to life flooded his mind. His anxiety about Charlotte was laced with fury for throwing life away. And then his phone rang.
"Where are you?"
he almost shouted.
"Bluey."
She sounded drunk, or very stoned.
"Where are you?"
"Told you," she mumbled. "Bluey, do you remember?"
"Charlotte, where are you?"
"Told you. Simmons."
He turned and began to half run, half hobble back the way he'd come. There was an old-fashioned red telephone box 20 yards back, and with his free hand he was already pulling coins from his trouser pocket.
"Are you in your room? Where are you?"
The telephone box smelled urinous of cigarette butts and dirt from 1,000 silt-clogged soles.
"Can see sky, bluey, I'm so..."
She was still mumbling, her breathing slow.
118, 118. Said a cheery voice through the receiver in his hand.
"Simmons House. It's a residential psychiatric clinic in Kent."
"Shall I connect?"
"Yes, connect me.
Charlotte, are you still there? Talk to me. Where are you?"
But she didn't answer. Her breathing was loud and becoming guttural.
"Simmons House," said a bright female voice in the other ear.
"Have you got an inpatient there called Charlotte Ross?"
"I'm sorry, sir," said the receptionist. "We don't disclose.
She's overdosed. She's just called me from your facility, and she's overdosed. You need to find her.
She might be outside. Have you got grounds there?
Sir, can I ask you,
check Charlotte Ross's whereabouts now. I've got her on another line and she's overdosed.
He heard the woman speaking to someone away from the phone. Mrs. Ross, first floor, just to make... The voice spoke in his ear again, still professionally bright, but anxious now.
Sir, what number is Mrs. Ross calling from?
She, inpatients, don't have their own mobiles.
Well, she's got one from somewhere, said Strike, as well as a shitload of drugs.
Somewhere in the background of the call, he heard shouting, then loud footsteps. He tried to insert another coin into the slot, but it fell straight through and came out at the bottom.
Fuck!
Sir, I'm going to ask you not to talk to me like that.
No, I just...
The line went dead. Charlotte's breath was now barely audible. Strike slammed as much change as he had in his pockets into the slot, then redialed telephone inquiries. Within a minute, he was again connected to the female voice at Simmons' house.
Simmons' house?
Have you found her? I got cut off. Have you found her?
I'm afraid I can't disclose, said the harassed-sounding woman.
She got out of a mobile and the means to kill herself on your watch, said Strike, so you can bloody well disclose whether she's dead.
Sir, I'd appreciate you not shouting at me.
But then Strike heard distant male voices through the mobile clamped to his other ear. There was no point hanging up and ringing. Charlotte hadn't heard his 10 previous calls. She must have the mobile on silent.
"She's here!" he bellowed,
and the woman on the payphone line shrieked in shock.
"Follow my voice! She's here!"
Strike was bellowing into the phone, well aware of the almost impossible odds of searchers hearing him. He could hear swishing and cracking, and knew that Charlotte was outside, probably in the undergrowth. Then, through the mobile, he heard a man shout.
"Shit! She's here! She's here! Fuck! Get an ambulance!"
"Sir," said the shell-shocked woman, now that Strike had stopped yelling, "could I have your name?"
But Strike hung up. Over the sound of his change clattering into the returned coin box, he continued to listen to the two men who'd found Charlotte, one of them shouting details of her overdose to the emergency services, the other repeatedly calling Charlotte's name, until somebody noticed that the mobile beside her was active and turned it off. Chapter 55. Of lovers, sad calamities of old, full many piteous stories do remain. Edmund Spenser, The Faerie Queen. As a noted beauty and socialite, with a tantalizing number of celebrity connections and a rebellious, self-destructive past, Charlotte was an old staple of the gossip columns. Naturally, her emergency hospitalization out of a private psychiatric clinic made news. The tabloids ran photo-heavy stories showing Charlotte at the ages of 14, when she'd first run away from her private school and sparked a police hunt. 18, arm-in-arm with her well-known broadcaster father, a thrice-married heavy drinker. 21, with her model-turned-socialite mother at a cocktail party. And 38, where, as beautiful as ever, she smiled blankly alongside her white blonde husband, twin babies in her arms, an exquisite drawing room in the background. Nobody had been able to find a picture of her with Cormoran Strike, but the fact that they'd once dated, which Charlotte herself had been careful to mention to the press when she got engaged to Jago, ensured that his name appeared in print alongside hers. Emergency hospitalization, history of addiction issues, trouble past. Though the tabloids didn't say so explicitly, only the most naive reader could be left in doubt that Charlotte had attempted to take her own life. The story gained a second wind when an unnamed inside source at Simmons' house confided that the future Viscountess Ross had allegedly been found face down in a shrubbery right behind an old summer house. The broadsheet stories led with the questionable practices of the exorbitantly priced Simmons' house, which, said the Telegraph, has a reputation for being the last resort of the wealthy and well-connected. Controversial treatments include transcranial magnetic stimulation and the hallucinogen psilocybin, more commonly known as magic mushrooms. They, too, used large photographs of Charlotte to embellish their stories, so Robin, who furtively read all of them and felt guilty afterwards, was reminded constantly how very beautiful Strike's ex had always been. Strike hadn't mentioned a word of the business to Robin, and she hadn't asked. A moratorium had lain over Charlotte's name ever since that night, 4 years previously, when Robin had still been the temp, and an extremely drunk Strike confided in her that Charlotte had lied about being pregnant with his child. All Robin knew right now was that Strike had returned from Cornwall in a particularly buttoned-up mood, and while she knew that the disposal of his aunt's ashes must have been a sad occasion, she couldn't help suspecting this other source for his moodiness. Out of loyalty to Strike, she refused to gossip about his ex, even though everyone around her seemed to want to talk about it. A week after Strike returned from Cornwall, Robin entered the office, already in a bad mood, because Matthew had again postponed mediation. On seeing the door open, Pat the secretary hastily tried to hide a copy of the Daily Mail she'd been poring over with Morris. On realizing that the new arrival was Robin rather than Strike, Pat had given her Raven's Caw of laughter and slapped the paper back onto her desk. "Caught red-handed," said Morris, with a wink at Robin. "Seeing all this about the boss's ex?" "He's not my boss, he's my partner," thought Robin. But she merely said, "Yes." "Talk about punching above his bloody weight," said Morris, examining a picture of Charlotte at 21 in a beaded mini-dress. "The fuck did a bloke who looks like him end up with that?" Robin wasn't even safe from it at home. Max, whose floppy hair had been cropped short to play the ex-army officer, had begun shooting his TV series and was more cheerful than she'd ever known him. Max was also thoroughly intrigued to know that Strike had been involved with Charlotte for 16 years. "I met her once," he told Robin, who'd come upstairs after several hours in her room, combing online records for Betty Fuller. The one-time prostitute was proving harder to find than she'd anticipated. "Really?" said Robin, who both wanted and didn't want to hear the story. "Yeah, I was in a play years ago with a half-brother. Simon Lagarde? He starred in that mini-series about the financial crash. What was it called? She came to watch our play and took us all out for dinner afterwards. I liked her, actually. She was a real laugh. Some of those posh girls are a lot funnier than you'd think." Said Robin, noncommittally, and she returned immediately to her room with her cup of tea. "I bet she tried to call Coram before she did it," was Isla's cool comment on the phone, 2 weeks after Easter, by which time Robin had succeeded, through patient cross-referencing, in identifying the woman she thought was most likely to be the Betty Fuller who'd lived in Skinner Street at the time of Margot Bamborough's disappearance. Betty was now living in sheltered housing in Sands Walk, not far from her original flat, and Robin planned to pay her a visit the following afternoon, after the mediation with Matthew, which seemed, at last, to be going ahead. Isla had rung to wish Robin good luck. Robin had been trying not to think about having to see Matthew, telling herself that the ordeal would be over in a couple of hours, but it had become progressively harder to focus on her list of questions for Betty Fuller as the evening progressed, and she'd been glad, initially, to be interrupted by Isla. "What's Coram saying about the whole Charlotte thing?" Isla asked. "Nothing," said Robin truthfully. "No, he never talks about her any more," said Isla. "I wonder how much longer her marriage is going to last. Must be hanging by a thread. I'm quite surprised it's limped on this long, actually. She only did it to get back at Coram." "Well, she's had children with Jago," Robin pointed out, then instantly regretted it. Isla had already told her that she and Nick had decided not to try a fourth round of IVF. "She never wanted kids," said Isla. "That was something she and Coram had in common. That and having really similar mothers. Drink, drugs, and a million men each. Except Charlotte's is still alive. So, you haven't spoken to him about it all?" "No," said Robin, who was feeling marginally worse for this conversation, in spite of Isla's kind intentions. "Isla, sorry, but I'd better go. I've got work to do for tomorrow." "Can't you take the afternoon off? We could meet for a coffee. You'll probably need some R&R afterwards. Corn wouldn't mind, would he?" "I'm sure he wouldn't," said Robin, "but we're so busy and I'm following up a lead. Anyway, work gives me something to think about other than Matthew. Let's catch up at the weekend, if you're free." Robin slept badly that night. It wasn't Charlotte who wove her way in and out of her dreams, but Miss Jones, the agency's client who, as everyone had now noticed, had taken such a shine to Strike that he'd had to ask Pat to stop putting her calls through. Robin woke before her alarm went off, glad to escape a complicated dream in which it was revealed that Miss Jones had been Matthew's wife all along, and that Robin was defending herself against a charge of fraud at the end of a long, polished table in a dark boardroom. Wanting to look professional and confident, she dressed in black trousers and jacket, even though Matthew knew perfectly well that she spent most of her investigative life in jeans. Casting one last look in her mirror before leaving her room, she thought she looked washed out. Trying not to think of all those pictures of Charlotte Ross, who rarely dressed in anything but black, but whose porcelain beauty merely shone brighter in contrast, Robin grabbed her handbag and left her room. While waiting for the tube, Robin tried to distract herself from the squirming feeling of nerves in her stomach by checking her emails. "Dear Miss Ellicott, as previously stated, I'm not prepared to talk to anyone except Mr. Strike. This is not intended as any slight on you, but I would feel more comfortable speaking man to man. Unfortunately, I will be unavailable from the end of next week due to work commitments which will be taking me out of the country. However, I can make space on the evening of the 24th. If this is agreeable to Mr. Strike, I suggest the American Bar in the Stafford Hotel as a discreet meeting place. Kindly let me know if this is acceptable. Sincerely, C. B. Oakden." 20 minutes later, when she'd emerged from Holborn Tube Station and had reception again, Robin forwarded this message to Strike. She had a comfortable quarter of an hour to spare before her appointment, and there were plenty of places to grab a coffee in her vicinity. But before she could do so, her mobile rang. It was Pat at the office.
"Robin," said the familiar croaking voice, "do you know where Cormoran is? I've tried his phone, but he's not picking up. I've got his brother Al here in the office wanting to see him."
"Really?" said Robin, startled. She'd met Al a couple of years previously, but knew that he and Strike weren't close.
"No, I don't know where he is, Pat. Have you left a message? He's probably somewhere he can't pick up." "Yeah, I've left a voicemail," said Pat. "All right, I'll keep trying him. Bye."
Robin walked on, her desire for a coffee forgotten in her curiosity about Al turning up at the office. She'd quite liked Al when she'd met him. He seemed in slight awe of his older half-brother, which Robin had found endearing. Al didn't look much like Strike, being shorter with straight hair, a narrow jaw, and the slight divergent squint he'd inherited from their famous father. Thinking about Strike's family, she turned the corner and saw, with a thrill of dread that brought her to a halt, Matthew climbing out of a taxi, wearing an unfamiliar dark overcoat over his suit. His head turned, and for a moment they were looking at each other, 50 yards apart, like gunslingers ready to fire. Then Robin's mobile rang. She reached for it automatically, and when she put it to her ear and looked up, Matthew had disappeared into the building.
"Hello?" "Hi," said Strike. "Just got the email from Oakden. Out of the country, my arse."
Robin glanced at her watch. She still had 5 minutes, and her lawyer, Judith, was nowhere in sight. She drew back against the cold stone wall and said,
"Yeah, I thought that too. Have you rung Pat back?"
"No, why?"
"Al's at the office."
"Al who?"
"Your brother Al,"
said Robin. There was a brief pause.
"Fuck's sake," said Strike under his breath.
"Where are you?"
asked Robin.
"At a B&Q in Chingford. Our blonde friend in Stoke Newington shopping."
"What for?"
"Rubber foam and MDF, for starters," said Strike. "That bloke from Shifty's gym's helping her. Where are you?"
"Waiting outside Matthew's lawyer's. It's mediation morning," said Robin.
"Shit," said Strike. "I forgot. Best of luck. Listen, take the rest of the day off if you'd—"
"I don't want time off," said Robin.
She'd just spotted Judith in the distance, walking briskly towards her in a red coat. "I'm planning to go and see Betty Fuller afterwards. I'd better go, Cormoran. Speak later." She hung up and walked forwards to meet Judith, who smiled broadly.
"All right,"
she asked, patting Robin on the arm with a hand not holding her briefcase. "Should be fine. You let me do the talking."
"Right," said Robin, smiling back with as much warmth as she could muster.
They walked up the steps together into a small lobby area, where a stocky, suited man, with a haircut like Caesar's, came forward with a perfunctory smile, his hand outstretched to Judith.
"Miss Cobbs, Andrew Shenstone, Miss Ellicott, how do you do?"
His handshake left Robin's hand throbbing. He and Judith walked ahead of Robin through double doors, chatting about London traffic, and Robin followed, dry-mouthed and feeling like a child trailing its parents. After a short walk up a dark corridor, They turned left into a small meeting room with an oval table and a shabby blue carpet. Matthew was sitting there alone, still wearing his overcoat. He readjusted himself in his chair when they entered. Robin looked directly into his face as she sat down, diagonally opposite him. To her surprise, Matthew looked instantly away. She'd imagined him glaring across the table with that strange, muzzle-like whitening around his mouth he'd worn during arguments towards the end of their marriage.
"Right, then," said Andrew Shenstone with another smile, as Judith Cobbs opened the file she'd brought with her.
He had a leather document holder sitting, closed, in front of him.
"Your client's position remains as stated in your letter of the 14th, Judith. Is that correct?"
"That's right," said Judith, her thick black glasses perched on the end of her nose as she scanned a copy of said letter.
"Miss Ellicott's perfectly happy to forego any claim on your client, except in respect of the proceeds from the sale of the flat in,
Hastings Road," thought Robin. She remembered moving into the cramped conversion with Matthew, excitedly carrying boxes of pot plants and books up the short path. Matthew plugging in the coffee machine that had been one of their first joint purchases, the fluffy elephant he'd given her so long ago, sitting on the bed.
"Hastings Road, yes," said Judith, scanning her letter, "from which she'd like the £10,000 her parents contributed to the deposit upon purchase."
"£10,000, repeated Andrew Shenstone. He and Matthew looked at each other.
"In that case, we're agreeable."
"You're agreeable," said Judith Cobbs, as surprised as Robin herself.
"My client's circumstances have changed," said Shenstone. "His priority now is securing the divorce as speedily as possible, which I think your client has indicated is also preferable to her, accepting the £10,000. Of course," added Shenstone, "we're almost at the requisite 2 years, so—"
Judith looked at Robin, who nodded, her mouth still dry.
"Then I think we can conclude things today. Very good indeed," said Andrew Shenstone complacently, and it was impossible to escape the suspicion that he was addressing himself. "I've taken the liberty of drawing up—"
He opened his document holder, spun it around on the polished tabletop, and pushed it towards Judith, who read the document inside carefully.
"Yes," she said finally, sliding the document sideways to Robin, who learned that Matthew was promising to transfer the money to Robin's account within 7 days of signature.
"Happy?" Judith added in an undertone to Robin.
"Yes," said Robin, slightly dazed.
What, she wondered, had been the point of dragging her here? Had it been one last demonstration of power, or had Matthew only decided that morning to give in? She reached into her handbag, but Judith was already holding out her own fountain pen, so Robin took it and signed. Judith passed the document back to Andrew Shenstone, who slid it over to Matthew, who scrawled a hasty signature. He glanced up at Robin when he'd done so, then looked quickly away again. And in that moment Robin knew what had happened, and why he'd given her what she wanted.
"Very good," said Andrew Shenstone again, and he slapped the table with his thick hand and laughed. "Well, short and sweet, eh? I think we're—"
"Yes," said Judith, with a little laugh. "I think we are." Matthew and Robin rose and watched their lawyers gathering up their things, and in Judith's case, pulling her coat back on. Disorientated by what had just happened, Robin again had the sensation of being a child with its parents, unsure how to quit the situation, waiting for the lawyers to release her. Andrew Shenstone held the door open for Robin, and she passed back into the corridor, heading towards the lobby. Behind her, the lawyers were talking about traffic again. When they paused in the lobby to take leave of each other, Matthew, after a brief word of thanks to Shenstone, walked straight out past Robin into the street. Robin waited for Andrew Shenstone to disappear inside the building again before addressing Judith.
"Thanks so much," she said.
"Well, I didn't really do much, did I?" said Judith, laughing. "But mediation often brings people to their senses. I've seen it happen before. Much harder to justify yourself in a room with objective observers." They shook hands, and Robin headed out into a spring breeze that blew her hair into her mouth. She felt slightly unsettled. £10,000. She'd offered to give it back to her parents, knowing that they'd struggled to match Matthew's parents' contribution, but they'd told her to keep it. She'd have to settle her bill with Judith, of course, but the remainder would give her a buffer, maybe even help her back towards her own place. She turned a corner, and there, right in front of her, standing at the curb, his arm raised in his attempt to hail a taxi, was Matthew. Catching sight of her, he stood frozen for a moment, his hand still raised, and the taxi he'd been trying to hail slowed 10 yards away and picked up a couple instead. "Sarah's pregnant, isn't she?" said Robin. He looked down at her, not quite as tall as Strike, but as good-looking as he'd been at 17 on the day he'd asked her out. "Yeah," he hesitated. "It was an accident."
Was it hell? Thought Robin.
Sarah had always known how to get what she wanted. Robin realized at last how long a game Sarah had played. Always present, giggling, flirting, prepared to settle for Matthew's best friend to keep him close. Then, as her clutch tightened, but Matthew threatened to slip through it, there'd been the diamond earring she'd left in Robin's bed, and now, still more valuable, a pregnancy to make sure of him before he could enter a dangerous state of singledom. Robin had a strong suspicion that this was what had lain behind the two postponements of mediation. Had a newly hormonal and insecure Sarah made scenes, frightened of Matthew coming face to face with Robin while he hadn't yet decided whether he wanted either the baby or its mother? "And she wants to be married before she has it."
"Yeah," said Matthew. "Well, so do I."
Did the image of their own wedding flash across his mind as it flashed across Robin's? The church in Masham that both of them had attended since primary school, the reception in that beautiful hotel with the swans in the lake that refused to swim together, and the disastrous reception during which Robin had known, for a few terrifying seconds, that if Strike had asked her to leave with him, she'd have gone.
"How are things with you?"
"Great,"
said Robin.
She put up a good front. What you do when you meet the ex, isn't it? Pretend you think you did the right thing. No regrets.
"Well," he said, as the traffic rolled past, "I need to..." He began to walk away. "Matt." He turned back.
"What?"
"I'll never forget how you were when I really needed you. Whatever else, I'll never forget that part." For a fraction of a second, his face worked slightly, like a small boy's. Then he walked back to her, bent down, and before she knew what was happening, he'd hugged her quickly, then let go as though she was red hot.
"Good luck, Robs,"
he said thickly, and walked away for good.
Chapter 56. Whereas this lady, like a sheep astray, now drowned in the depth of sleep, all fearless lay. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. At the precise moment Matthew turned to walk away from Robin in Holborn, Strike, who was sitting in his parked car 3 miles away, outside the familiar terraced house in Stoke Newington, decided to call his brother, lest Al sit in wait for him at the office all day. The detective's anger was shot through with other, less easily identifiable feelings, of which the least painful to acknowledge was grudging admiration for Al's persistence. Strike didn't doubt that Al had come to the office for a last-ditch attempt to persuade Strike into some form of reconciliation with his father, preferably before or during the party to celebrate his father's new album. Having always considered Al a fairly weak and sybaritic character, Strike had to admit he was showing guts, risking his older brother's fury. Strike waited until Eleanor Dean had unloaded the foam and the cheap wood from her car and carried it all inside with the aid of her friend from Shifty's gym, watched the front door close, then called Al's number.
"Hi," said Al, picking up after a single ring.
"Why are you in my office?" asked Strike.
"Wanted to see you, bruv. Talk face to face."
"Well, I won't be back there today," lied Strike. "So I suggest you say whatever it is you've got to say now."
"Bruv, who's there with you?"
Your secretary, Pat, is it?" Strike heard Al turn away from his mobile to check, and heard Pat's core of agreement.
"And a bloke called
Barclay,"
said the Scot loudly in the background.
"Right, well,"
go into my office for some privacy," said Strike. He listened while Al told Pat what Strike had asked him to do, heard the familiar sound of his own office door closing, then said, "If this is about what I think it's about, Cormoran, we didn't want to tell you this, but Dad's got cancer." "Oh, for fuck's sake." Strike leaned forwards momentarily and rested his forehead on the steering wheel of his car before he sat up again. "Prostate," Al continued. "They reckon they caught it early. But we thought you should know, because this party isn't just about celebrating the band's anniversary and the new album. It's about giving him something to look forward to." There was a silence. "We thought you should know," Al repeated. "Why should I fucking know?" thought Strike, eyes on the closed door of Eleanor Dean's house. He had no relationship with Rokeby. Did Al expect him to weep, to rush to Rokeby's side, to express compassion or pity? Rokeby was a multimillionaire. Doubtless he'd enjoy the very best treatment. The memory of Joan's lily urn bobbing away on the sea recurred as Strike said, "Okay, well, I don't really know how to respond to that. I'm sure it's a bugger for everyone who cares about him." Another long silence followed. "We thought this might make a difference," said Al quietly. "To what?" "To your attitude." "As long as they've caught it early, he'll be fine," said Strike bracingly. "Probably live to father another couple of kids he never sees." "Jesus Christ," said Al, really angry now. "You might not give a shit, but he happens to be my dad. I give a shit about people who've ever given a shit about me," said Strike. "And keep your fucking voice down. Those are my employees you're airing my private business in front of. That's your priority." Strike thought of Charlotte, who, according to the papers, remained in hospital, and of Lucy, who was agitating to know whether Strike would be able to take the weekend off to join Ted at her house in Bromley for the weekend. He thought of the clients in the Shifty case, who were hinting they'd terminate payment in a week's time unless the agency found out what hold Shifty had on his boss. He thought of Margot Bamborough and the rapidly vanishing year they'd been allotted to find out what had happened to her. Inexplicably, he thought of Robin, and the fact that he'd forgotten that today was her mediation session with Matthew. "I've got a life," said Strike, keeping a curb on his temper only by exercising maximum self-control, "which is hard and complicated, just like anyone else's. Rokeby's got a wife and half a dozen kids, and I'm at maximum capacity for people who need me. I'm not coming to his fucking party. I'm not interested in hearing from him. I don't want a relationship with him. I don't know how much clearer I can make this, Al, but I'm..." The line went dead. Without regretting anything he'd said, but nevertheless breathing heavily, Strike threw his mobile onto the passenger seat, lit a cigarette, and watched Eleanor Dean's front door for another 15 minutes until, on a sudden whim, he snatched up the phone from beside him again and called Barclay.
"What are you doing right now?"
"Filing my expenses," said the Scot laconically. "That casino cost ye a fortune."
"Is my brother still there?"
"No, he left."
"Good. I need you to come and take over in Stoke Newington."
"I haven't got my car with me."
"Okay, well, fuck it then," said Strike angrily.
"I'm sorry, Strike," said Barclay, "but I'm supposed to have this afternoon off."
"No, I'm sorry," said Strike, closing his eyes.
He had the same sensation of a wire tightening around his forehead that he'd experienced in St. Moore's.
"Getting frustrated. Enjoy your afternoon off. Seriously," he added, in case Barclay thought he was being sarcastic.
Having hung up on Barclay, Strike rang Robin.
"How did mediation go?"
"Fine," said Robin, though she sounded strangely flat. "We've settled."
"Great."
"Yeah, it's a relief."
"Did you say you were going to Betty Fuller's?"
"Yes. I was just about to head into the tube."
"Remind me where she lives."
"Sheltered housing on Sands Walk in Clerkenwell."
"Okay, I'll meet you there," said Strike.
"Really? I'm fine to..."
"I know, but I want to be there." Strike cut across her.
He pulled away from Eleanor Dean's house, knowing that he'd just been abrasive towards his two favourite colleagues.
If he was going to vent his temper, it could at least have been at Pat and Morris's expense. 20 minutes later, Strike entered Clerkenwell via Percival Street. To his right were the nondescript red brick flats where Janice Beattie and Steve Douthwaite had once lived, and he wondered yet again what had become of Margot's one-time patient, whose whereabouts, in spite of his and Robin's best efforts, remained unknown. Sands Walk was a narrow, pedestrianized one-way street. Strike parked his BMW as close to it as possible. The day was surprisingly warm, in spite of a good amount of cloud. As he approached Sands Walk, he saw Robin waiting for him at the entrance.
"Hi," she said. "It's up the other end, that red brick modern building with the circular tower thing on top."
"Great," said Strike, as they set off together. "Sorry for earlier, I..."
"No, it's fine," said Robin. "I know we really need results soon."
But Strike thought he detected a slight coolness.
"Al pissed me off," he explained. "So I might have been a bit..."
"Cormoran is fine," repeated Robin, but with a smile that reassured Strike.
"Great news about the mediation," he said.
"Yes," said Robin, though she didn't look particularly pleased. "So what do you think's the best tack to take with Betty Fuller?"
"Be honest and direct about who we are and what we're investigating," said Strike. "And then play it by ear, I think. And hope to Christ she's not demented."
Priory House was a modern, multi-level building with a shared garden at the back. As they approached the front doors, a middle-aged couple came out. They had the relieved look of people who'd just done their duty, and, smiling at Strike and Robin, they held open the door to let them walk inside.
"Thanks very much," said Robin, smiling at them. As the couple walked on, she heard the woman say, "At least she remembered who we are this time."
Had it not been for the mobility scooters, the place would have resembled a hall of residence, with its hardy dark grey carpet underfoot, its bulletin board bristling with pamphlets, and a depressing smell of communal cooking hanging in the air.
"She's on the ground floor," said Robin, pointing towards a corridor. "I checked the names on the buzzer."
They passed a number of identical pine doors until they reached the one with "Elizabeth Fuller" printed on a card in a metal holder. Through the wood came the muffled sounds of voices. Just as it had been when he'd visited Janice Beattie, the TV was turned up very high inside. Strike rapped hard on the door. After a lengthy wait, the door opened very slowly to reveal a panting old lady wearing a nasal cannula, who'd pulled her oxygen tank to the door with her. Over her shoulder, Strike saw a TV blaring the reality show "The Only Way is Essex."
"I'm fine. You just upset me, Og,"
a heavily made-up girl in bright blue was saying on screen. Betty Fuller looked as though she'd been subject to heavier gravity than the rest of humankind. Everything about her had sagged and drooped. The corners of her lipless mouth, her papery eyelids, her loose jowls, the tip of her thin nose. It appeared that the flesh had been sucked down out of her upper body into her lower. Betty had almost no bust, but her hips were broad, and her poor bare legs were immensely swollen, both ankles thicker than her neck. She wore what looked like a pair of men's slippers and a dark green knitted dress, on which there were several stains. A yellowish scalp was clearly visible through the sparse grey hair slicked back off her face, and a hearing aid was prominent in her left ear.
"Who are you?"
she wheezed, looking from Robin to Strike.
"Afternoon, Mrs. Fuller," said Strike loudly and clearly. "My name's Cormoran Strike, and this is Robin Ellicott."
He pulled his driver's license out of his pocket and showed it to her with his card. She made an impatient gesture to show she couldn't read them. Her eyes were milky with glaucoma.
"We're private detectives," said Strike, voice still raised over the arguing pair on screen.
"At the end of the day, Lucy, she slept on a one-night stand with a boy."
"Ugh, ugh, ugh, this is irrelevant."
"We've been hired to try and find out what happened to Margot Bamborough. She was a doctor who..."
"Who?"
"Dr. Margot Bamborough," Strike repeated, still more loudly. "She went missing from Clerkenwell in 1974. We heard you..."
"Oh, yeah,"
said Betty Fuller.
who appeared to need to draw breath every few words.
Dr. Bamborough! Yeah!
Well, we wondered whether we could talk to you about her. Betty Fuller stood there for what seemed a very long 20 seconds, thinking this over, while on screen a young man in a maroon suit said to the over-made-up girl, I didn't want to bring it up, but you come over to me. Betty Fuller made an impatient gesture, turned and shuffled back inside. Strike and Robin glanced at each other.
Is it all right to come in, Mrs. Fuller?
Asked Strike loudly. She nodded, having carefully positioned her oxygen tank. She fell back into her armchair, then tugged the knitted dress in an effort to make it cover her knees. Strike and Robin entered the room and Strike closed the door. Watching the old lady struggle to pull her dress down, Robin had an urge to take a blanket off the unmade bed and place it decorously over her lap. Robin had discovered during her research that Betty was 84. The old lady's physical state shocked her. The small room smelled of B.O. and urine. A door showed a small toilet leading off the single bedroom. Through the open wardrobe door, Robin saw crumpled clothes which had been thrown there and two empty wine bottles, half hidden in underwear. There was nothing on the walls except a cat calendar. The month of May showed a pair of ginger kittens peeking out from between pink geranium blossoms.
"Would it be all right to turn this down?"
Strike shouted over the TV, where the couple on screen continued to argue, the woman's eyelashes as thick as woolly bear caterpillars.
"Turn it off!" said Betty Fuller. "It's a recording!"
The Essex voices were suddenly extinguished. The two detectives looked around. There were only two choices for seats, the unmade bed and a hard, upright chair. So Robin took the former, Strike the latter. Removing his notebook from his pocket, Strike said,
"We've been hired by Dr. Bamborough's daughter, Mrs. Fuller, to try and find out what happened to her."
Betty Fuller made a noise like,
"Hm?"
which sounded disparaging, although Strike thought it might also have been an attempt to clear phlegm out of her throat. She rocked slightly to one side in her chair and pulled, ineffectually, at the back of her dress. Her swollen lower legs were knotted with varicose veins.
"So, you remember Dr. Bamborough disappearing, do you, Mrs. Fuller?"
"Yes,"
she grunted, still breathing heavily. In spite of her incapacity and unpromising manner, Strike had the impression of somebody both more alert than they might appear at first glance, and happier to have company and attention than the unprepossessing exterior might suggest.
"You were living in Skinner Street then, weren't you?"
She coughed, which seemed to clear her lungs, and in a slightly steadier voice she said,
"Was there till last year. Michael Cliff House, top floor. Couldn't manage no more."
Strike glanced at Robin. He'd expected her to lead the interrogation, assumed Betty would respond better to a woman. But Robin seemed oddly passive, sitting on the bed, her gaze wandering over the small room.
"Were you one of Dr. Bamborough's patients?" Strike asked Betty.
"Yeah,"
wheezed Betty.
"I was."
Robin was thinking, is this where single people end up? People without children to look out for them, without double incomes, in small boxes, living vicariously through reality stars. Next Christmas, no doubt, she'd run into Matthew, Sarah, and their new baby in Masham. She could just imagine Sarah's proud strut through the streets, pushing a top-of-the-range pushchair, Matthew beside her, and a baby with Sarah's white blonde hair peeking over the top of the blankets. Now, when Jenny and Stephen ran into them, there'd be common ground, the shared language of parenthood. Robin decided there and then, sitting on Betty Fuller's bed, to make sure she didn't go home next Christmas. She'd offer to work through it if necessary.
"Did you like Dr. Bamborough?" Strike was asking Betty.
"She were all right,"
said Betty.
"Did you ever meet any of the other doctors at the practice?" asked Strike.
Betty Fuller's chest rose and fell with her laboured breathing. Though it was hard to tell with the nasal cannula in the way, Strike thought he saw a thin smile.
"Yeah,"
she said.
"Which ones?"
"Brenner,"
she said hoarsely, and coughed again.
needed an house call. Emergency. She weren't available.
So Dr. Brenner came out to see you?
Said
Betty Fuller.
Yeah.
There were a few small, cheaply framed photographs on the windowsill, Robin noticed. Two of them showed a fat tabby cat, presumably a lamented pet, but there were also a couple showing toddlers, and one of two big-haired teenaged girls wearing puff-sleeved dresses from the 80s. So you could end up alone in near squalor, even if you had children. Was it solely money, then, that made the difference? She thought of the £10,000 she'd be receiving into her bank account later that week, which would be reduced immediately by legal bills and council tax. She'd need to be careful not to fritter it away. She really needed to start saving, to start paying into a pension. "You must have been seriously unwell, were you?" Strike was asking Betty. "To need a house call." He had no particular reason for asking, except to establish a friendly conversational atmosphere. In his experience of old ladies, there was little they enjoyed more than discussing their health. Betty Fuller suddenly grinned at him, showing chipped yellow teeth.
"You ever taken it up the shitter with a 9-inch cock?"
Only by exercising the utmost restraint did Robin prevent herself letting out a shocked laugh. She had to hand it to Strike. He didn't so much as grin as he said, "Can't say I have."
"Well,"
wheezed Betty Fuller,
"you can take it from me. Fucking agony. Geezer went at me like a fucking power drill. Split my arsehole open."
She gasped for air, half laughing.
"My Cindy hears me moaning. Blood. Says, 'Mum, you gotta get that seen to. Called doctor.'"
"Cindy's your..."
"Daughter,"
said Betty Fuller.
"Yeah, got two. Cindy and Kathy."
"And Dr. Brenner came out to see you, did he?" asked Strike, trying not to dwell on the mental image Betty had conjured.
"Yeah, takes a look, sends me to A&E, yeah. 19 stitches,"
said Betty Fuller.
"And I sat on an ice pack for a week, and no fucking money coming in. After that,"
she panted,
"no anal, unless they was paying double, and nothing over 6 inches, neither."
She let out a cackle of laughter, which ended in coughs. Strike and Robin were carefully avoiding looking at each other. "Was that the only time you met Dr. Brenner?" asked Strike, when the coughing had subsided.
"No,"
croaked Betty Fuller, thumping her chest.
"I seen him regular, every Friday night, for months after."
She didn't seem to feel any qualms about telling Strike this. On the contrary, Strike thought she seemed to be enjoying herself. "When did that arrangement start?" asked Strike.
"Couple of weeks after he'd seen me for me arse," said Betty Fuller. "Knocked on me door with his doctor's bag, pretending he'd come to check. Then he says, 'Wants a regular appointment, Friday night, 6:30. Tell the neighbours medical if they ask.'"
Betty paused to cough noisily. When she'd quelled her rattling chest, she went on.
"And if I told anyone, he'd go to cops, say I was extorting him."
"Threatened you, did he?"
"Yeah,"
panted Betty Fuller, though without rancour.
"But he wasn't trying to get it free, so I kept me mouth shut."
"You never told Dr. Bamborough what was going on?" asked Robin. Betty looked sideways at Robin, who, in Strike's view, had rarely looked as out of place as she did sitting on Betty's bed. Young, clean and healthy, and perhaps Betty's drooping, occluded eyes saw his partner the same way, because she seemed to resent both question and questioner.
"Course I fucking didn't. She tried to get me to stop working. Brenner, easiest job of the week."
"Why was that?" asked Strike. Betty laughed wheezily again.
"He liked me. Lying still like I was coma, plain dead. He fucked me saying his dirty words. I pretended couldn't hear. Except once,
said Betty, with a half-chuckle, half-cough.
The bleeding firearm went off halfway. I said in his ear, I'm not staying dead if we're on fucking fire. I've got kids next room. He was livid. Turned out it was false alarm.
She cackled, then coughed again. Do you think Dr. Bamborough suspected Dr. Brenner of visiting you? Asked Robin.
No,
said Betty testily, with another sideways glance.
Course she fucking didn't. Was either of us going to tell her?
Was Brenner with you? Asked Strike, the night she went missing.
Yeah,
said Betty Fuller indifferently. He arrived and left at the usual times?
Yeah,
said Betty again. Did he keep visiting you after Dr. Bamborough disappeared?
No,
said Betty.
Police all over the surgery. No, he stopped coming. I heard he retired not long after. Dead now, I suppose.
Yes, said Strike. He is. The ruined face bore witness to past violence. Strike, whose own nose had been broken, was sure Betty's hadn't originally been the shape it was now, with its crooked tip. Was Brenner ever violent to you?
Never.
While your arrangement was going on, said Strike, did you ever mention it to anyone?
Nope,
said Betty. What about after Brenner retired? Asked Strike. Did you happen to tell a man called Tudor Athorne?
Clever, ain't ya?
Said Betty, with a cackle of mild surprise.
Yeah, I told Tudor. He's long gone as well. Used to drink with Tudor. His nephew's still round here grown up. I see him about retarded,
said Betty Fuller. In your opinion, said Strike, given what you know about Brenner, do you think he'd have taken advantage of a patient? There was a pause. Betty's milky eyes surveyed Strike.
Only if she was out cold.
Not otherwise, said Strike. Taking a deep breath of oxygen through her crooked nose, Betty said,
Man like that, when there's one thing what really gets him off, that's all he wants.
Did he ever want to drug you? Asked Strike.
No,
said Betty.
Didn't need to.
Do you remember, asked Strike, turning a page in his notebook, a social worker called Wilma Bayliss?
Colored girl,
said Betty.
Yeah, you smoke, don't you?
She added.
Can smell it. Give us one,
she said, and out of the wrecked old body came a whiff of flirtatiousness.
I don't think that's a good idea, said Strike, smiling, seeing as you're an oxygen.
Oh, fuck off, then,
said Betty.
Did you like Wilmer?
Who?
Wilma Bayliss, your social worker.
She were like they all are,
said Betty, with a shrug.
We spoke to Mrs. Bayliss's daughters recently, said Strike. They were telling us about the threatening notes that were sent to Dr. Bamborough before she disappeared.
Betty breathed in and out, her collapsed chest doing its valiant best for her, and a small squeak issued from her ruined lungs.
Do you know anything about those notes?
No,
said Betty.
I heard they'd been sent. Everyone heard, round here.
Who did they hear it from?
Probably that Irene Bull.
You remember Irene, do you? With many more pauses to catch her breath, Betty Fuller explained that her younger sister had been in the same year as Irene at school. Irene's family had lived in a road off Skinner Street, Corporation Row.
Thought her shit smelled of roses, that one,
said Betty. She laughed, but then broke yet again into a volley of hoarse coughs. When she'd recovered, she said,
The police asked them all not to talk. But the mouth on that girl, everyone knew there'd been threats made.
According to Wilma's daughters, said Strike, watching for Betty's reaction, you knew who sent those notes.
No, I never,
said Betty Fuller, no longer smiling.
You were sure Marcus Bayliss hadn't sent them, though.
Marcus, never. He was a lovely. You know, I always liked a darky, me,
said Betty Fuller,
and Robin, hoping Betty hadn't seen her wince, looked down at her hands.
"Very handsome. I'd have given it him for free. Big tall man,"
said Betty wistfully.
"Kind man. No, he never threatened no doctor."
"So who'd you think?"
"My second girl, my Kathy,"
continued Betty, determinedly deaf.
"Her dad was a darkie. Dunno who he was. Condom split. I kept her 'cause I like kids, but she don't give a shit about me. Smackhead,"
said Betty fiercely.
"I never touched it. Seen too many go that way. Stole from me. I told her, keep the fuck my house. Cindy's good,"
gasped Betty. She was fighting her breathlessness now, though still relishing Strike's captive attention.
"Cindy drops by, earning decent money."
"Really?" said Strike, playing along, waiting for his opportunity. "What does Cindy do?"
"Escort,"
wheezed Betty.
"Lovely figure, up west, making more than I ever. Arabs and whatnot, but she says, Ma, you wouldn't like it these days. All they want is anal."
Betty cackled, coughed, and then, without warning, turned her head to look at Robin perched on the bed, and said with vitriol,
"She don't find it funny, this one, do you?"
she demanded of Robin, who was taken aback.
"'Spect you give it away for meals and jewellery and think it's free. Look at her face,"
wheezed Betty, eyeing Robin with dislike.
"You're the same as the sniffy fucking social worker we had round when I minding Kathy's kids. Gone now,"
said Betty angrily.
"Took into care. New Mrs. Fuller,"
said Betty, adopting a grotesquely genteel accent.
"New, it makes new difference to me how you ladies make ends meet. Sex work is work. They'll tell you that, patronising fucking. But would they want their daughters doing it? Would they fuck?"
said Betty Fuller, and she paid for her longest speech yet with her most severe spate of coughing.
"Cindy does too much coke,"
Betty wheezed, her eyes watering when she could talk again.
"Keeps the weight off. Kathy, it was smack. Boyfriend, working for him, beat her blue, pregnant, and lost it."
"I'm sorry to hear that," said Strike.
"It's all kids on the street these days,"
said Betty, and a glimmer of what Strike thought was real distress showed through the determinedly tough exterior.
13, 14 children, my day. We'd have marched them right back home. It's all right, grown women, but kids. What you fucking staring at?"
she barked to Robin.
"Cormoran, I might," said Robin, standing up and gesturing towards the door.
"Yeah, off you fuck,"
said Betty Fuller, watching with satisfaction as Robin left her room.
"You doing her, are you?"
she wheezed at Strike, once the door had clicked shut behind Robin.
"No," he said.
"What the fuck's the point, then?"
"She's very good at the job," said Strike. "When she's not up against someone like you, that is."
And Betty Fuller grinned, displaying her cheddar yellow teeth.
"I know her type. Knows fucking nothing about real life."
"There was a man living in Leather Lane back in Margot Bamborough's day," said Strike. "Name of Niccolo Ricci. Mucky, they used to call him."
Betty Fuller said nothing, but the milky eyes narrowed.
"What do you know about Ricci?" asked Strike.
"Same as everyone,"
said Betty. Out of the corner of his eye, Strike saw Robin emerge into the daylight. She lifted her hair briefly off her neck, as though needing to remove weight from herself, then walked out of sight with her hands in her jacket pockets.
"It weren't Mucky what threatened her,"
said Betty.
"He wouldn't write notes, not his style.
Ricci turned up at the St. John's practice Christmas party, said Strike, which seemed odd.
Don't know nothing about that.
Some of the people at the party assumed he was Gloria Conti's father.
Never heard of her,
wheezed Betty. According to Wilma Bayliss's daughters, said Strike, you told their mother you were scared of the person who wrote the notes. You said the writer of the notes killed Margot Bamborough. You told Wilma he'd kill you too if you said who he was. Betty's milky eyes were expressionless. Her thin chest laboured to get enough oxygen into her lungs. Strike had just concluded that she definitely wasn't going to talk when she opened her mouth.
Local girl I knew, she said. Friend of mine. She met Mucky. He come cruising our corner. He says to Jen, you're better than this, working the street, body like yours. I could get you 5 times what you're earning here. So off Jen goes,
said Betty.
Up west, Soho, stripping for punters, sex with his mates. I met her a couple of years later, visiting her mum, and she told me a story. Girl at their club, gorgeous girl, Jen said, got raped, knife point. Cut,
said Betty Fuller, indicating her own sagging torso.
Right down the ribs, by a mate of Ricci's. Some people,
said the old woman,
think a hooker being raped, it just means she never got paid. Spec your miss stick it up her ass,
said Betty, glancing at the window.
Thinks that, but it ain't that. This girl, angry, wants revenge. Get back at Ricci. So the silly bitch turns police informer. And Mucky found out,
wheezed Betty Fuller.
And he filmed it as they killed her. My mate Jem was told by someone what had seen the film. Ricci kept it in the safe, show people if they needed scaring. Jen's dead now,
said Betty Fuller.
Overdosed. 30-odd years ago. Thought she'd be better up west than here's me, working the streets, still alive. I ain't got nothing to say about no notes. It weren't Marcus, that's all. That's my meals on wheels,
said Betty, her head turning, and Strike saw a man heading towards the outside door with a pile of foil trays in his arm.
I'm done,
Betty said, who seemed suddenly tired and cross.
You can turn telly back on and move that table over. Pass me that knife and fork in the loo.
She'd rinsed them off in the bathroom sink, but they were still dirty. Strike washed them again before taking them to her. After arranging the table in front of her armchair and turning the Only Wears Essex back on, he opened the door to the Meals on Wheels man, who was grey-haired and cheery.
"Oh, hello," said the newcomer in a loud voice. "This your son, Betty?"
"Is he fuck?"
wheezed Betty Fuller.
"What you got?"
"Chicken casserole and jelly and custard, love."
"Thanks very much for talking to me, Mrs. Fuller," said Strike. But Betty's stock of goodwill had plainly been exhausted, and she was now far more interested in her food. Robin was leaning against a nearby wall, reading something off her phone, when Strike emerged from the building. "I thought it was best to clear out," she said in a flat voice. "How did it go?"
"She won't talk about the notes," said Strike, as the pair of them headed back down Sands Walk. "And if you ask me why, I'd say it's because she thinks Mucky Ricci wrote them. I found out a bit more about that girl in the snuff movie."
"You're joking," said Robin, looking worried.
"Apparently she was a police informer in one of Ricci's..."
Robin gasped. "Cara Wolfson."
"What?"
"Cara Wolfson. One of the women they thought Creed might have killed. Cara worked at a nightclub in Soho. The owners put it about after she disappeared that she'd been a police informer."
"How did you know that?" asked Strike, taken aback. He couldn't remember this information from the Demon of Paradise Park.